you know, if you think that the U.S. has a Ponzi scheme, then you think that Great Britain's a Ponzi scheme and Italy's a Ponzi scheme and China is a Ponzi scheme and Russia. I mean, they all have the same thing, and they have various levels of debt and various levels of reserves, but they all have the same type of monetary system.
This will give you an idea of how quantitative easing works.
Yep.
Take printer out of box and place on table with the out tray facing the window.
The out tray facing the window.
That's right. Load paper into the paper receptacle and place currency on glass tray F.
Right.
Check alignment by printing out a test page.
Right.
Go into copy settings and select double-sided and the number of copies you require.
How many would you suggest?
In the case of one of our clients, it's 80 billion.
Hey everyone, and welcome back to Milkshakes Markets Madness. My name is John Katsumita. This is Brent Johnson, the man behind the dollar milkshake theory. If you're not familiar with what that is, check out our YouTube channel at Milkshakes Pod. At the top, you'll find a playlist that says Start Here that will explain the dollar milkshake theory and some of the other themes that we cover here frequently. Chances are some of the ideas that you hear around the internet about the dollar and the dollar's future are probably misguided versus our views, so we encourage you to dive into that material and get you caught up to speed. Brent, as you can see, I am wearing the fedora that's usually donned on the surfboard. We had a comment in the YouTube video asking me to wear it, so I figured I'd step up and give it a go.
Very good. Inspector Clouseau. Or maybe Inspector Gadget, one of the two.
I think I look more like Inspector Gadget, but I feel more like a Clouseau. So let's do some inspecting of our own on the markets. You know, I think there is these weeks that we get into where there's very important data sets, and then whether they're exciting or fireworks or somewhat duds, sometimes there's not much to look forward to the week after. It's like the Super Bowl and then the season's over. So this week, the main thing was the CPI inflation report. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Well, yeah. So, I mean, that was everybody's been waiting around for literally like 2 weeks waiting for the CPI report to come out because, you know, that's the main indicator that or inflation, not necessarily CPI, but inflation is the main indicator that the Fed is looking at to give them the go or no go on a rate cut. You know, Powell spoke on, I think it was it Wednesday? He testified to Congress Tuesday and Wednesday. You know, even in his prepared remarks, there was nothing really surprising. And then even during the testimony itself, nothing real surprising. To me, it's pretty clear, and I think most people would agree that they've indicated very strongly that they're planning to cut. And it sounds like it's going to be in September. You know, you and I've been talking about that for a while, that September was likely the time that they would cut, despite the fact that some people don't think that they will cut right in front of an election. I don't think that will stop them. And I think that's what we're on course for. But everybody's waiting for the big inflation prints to come out just to kind of confirm this expectation. And, you know, CPI came in a little soft, not super soft, but came in a little soft. And of course, everything just rallied like crazy because the release comes out at 8:30. The market, the regular market doesn't open until 9:30. This is Eastern time. But futures ramped on the news. And I think futures were up close to 1%. You know, on the various indices, whether it was the Dow, the NASDAQ, S&P. But by 8, you know, that was at 8:30. But by 8:45, it was starting to soften. I even sent out a tweet and I said, just be careful chasing anything this morning because, you know, this could all be gone by the end of the day. And sure enough, by the end of the day, everything was, not everything. What was interesting was the divergence between the indices again. What we've seen all year is growth outperforming. So the S&P and the NASDAQ outperforming, the Dow has gone up a little bit and the Russell has kind of been flat to down all year. But yesterday there was a huge rotation out of growth and into small caps. So NASDAQ sold off hard. I think it was down, 2% by the end of the day? The S&P was down a little bit. The Dow was flat, but the Russell was up like 3 or 4%. Just a huge divergence between the various indices. Well, and then this morning, there was another print today, PPI. And PPI came in a little bit hot, but then there was a couple, and even the revisions came in a little bit hot. But then I think one of the PPI readings, when you net out certain factors, it actually came in a little soft. And so the market kind of jumped on that a little bit. And then the University of Michigan inflation expectations came out like an hour or two later, and they came in a little soft. And so you know, markets were up. Markets for the most part recovered their losses from yesterday and were pretty much back to where they were kind of at the open or even pre-market a little bit yesterday by, you know, by 2:33 o'clock this afternoon. And then at 3:30, it was kind of interesting. You know, I always love watching the close on Friday. You know, I think a lot of people like leave the office, you know, early in the afternoon, especially in the summer. I always like watching the close on a Friday because especially, you know, when it's a holiday or when it's the summer, because when the markets are kind of thin and not many people around, that's when something can, it doesn't always happen, but that's when something kind of crazy can happen because you get these thin markets. And in the last 30 minutes, today, equities gave up half of the gains that they had made during the day. So equities kind of, I think they finished for the most part flat for the week, maybe up a little bit. I don't know if we closed at all-time highs, but I think we were pretty close to all-time highs across the indices. But the close was pretty interesting. And, you know, I think where we're at, John, is we've talked about this before, just everything is so extended. And it doesn't mean that it can't go higher, and it doesn't mean there's going to be a crash, but when I look at all the different indicators that I look at to see whether things are trading strong or trading weak, everything is trading strong. Sentiment is, you know, really high. Positioning is really high. You know, when I look at things like relative strength, they're super high. When I look at stochastics of various securities, they're really high. And it's across different things. You know, gold and silver had a pretty good week. You know, the equities had a pretty good week. You know, a lot of things were at their all-time highs. But then there was a few things that sold off, like Costco was down 5% a couple days ago. And then, you know, the NVIDIA sold off pretty hard yesterday on CPI. It recovered a little bit today and then kind of gave it back at the end of the day. So, you know, we're at the highs here. We're at this plateau at the all-time highs. And I think everything's just kind of running out of energy. And one thing I would say is a lot of times people think there needs to be some event to turn markets lower, you know, some unexpected announcement or some, you know, some crisis happens in some part of the world or some geopolitical event happens or some, you know, politician says something and then all of a sudden that reverses things. But really what can happen is you don't really need to have a catalyst to send things lower. If you just run out of catalyst to send things higher, and new buyers don't keep showing up, then you can start to get, you know, where prices kind of tend to go sideways a little bit. And then if you get a little bit of an air pocket, things can drop pretty quickly. So you don't really need some big event in order to turn things lower. You just need an absence of new catalyst to send it higher. And I kind of feel like that's where we're at. I'm not predicting a super big crash. I know a lot of people out there are extremely bearish and, you know, think we're going to have the next Great Depression or we're going to have a 70% correction. And, you know, that again, I've said this many times, that's not my base case. But what I do think we need is a pause and a pullback, some type of a correction, because that, to me, that's what then gives the market juice to then kind of break through these all times high and really move on to another level.
Yeah. One of the other tech darlings, I guess you could say, I don't know if it really fits into that category, that had a bit of a pullback this week was Tesla. It was down, I think, almost 7% yesterday. You know, we've been in such a wacky world, probably flush with liquidity is one reason why things have been doing what they've been doing the last 2 years. But people, you know, I think prior to 2020 and certainly before 2009, you saw a 5 or 6% pullback in a major equity like that, people would be very, very concerned. And now these things almost trade like crypto meme stocks. You know, to add some color to the data points you mentioned, so CPI, Consumer Price Index, you know, the inflation data is, you know, the Fed has the dual mandate, maximum employment and price stability. Price stability is really just referenced on maintaining this 2% inflation target. Well, based on the information that was showing up in the CPI, if you annualize that, at least the month-to-month numbers, you're going to be well below their 2% target, which is why, despite equity markets and everything else being at all-time highs, it kind of gives the Fed the cover to at least do the 25 basis points you're saying in September. Now, the PPI today, the Producer Price Index, is more forward-looking. So you're getting a sense of what the market, what businesses and industries are paying for materials and other types of product. So it gives you a sense of how that inflationary costs to them could be passed on to the consumer. So it certainly was conflicting and or concerning, but maybe the market processed it a little better because looking underneath of it at the components that would be applied to PCE, which is one of the Fed's favorite inflation metrics, the personal consumption expenditures, those parts of PPI actually came in soft. So the market's definitely now trying to read into the data a lot more. Like you said, you get these early ramp ups in the futures markets, probably algo driven, and then they get a chance to look under the hood and like, okay, well, maybe this still falls in line with the narrative. Now, going back to everything you've kind of mentioned as far as the things that are stretched here in the market feels exhausted. It's probably worth reminding people that despite your concerns, you're still more or less net long at this point.
Yeah, I'm pretty neutral right now. This week, we added some more hedges, and so we're pretty neutral right now. But again, I'm not like somebody who thinks we're going to have this massive, you know, Great Depression 2.0, and you know, markets are going to fall 70% and mass unemployment. And again, I totally understand the argument for it, and yeah, I won't be completely shocked if that happens. But that's not my expectation. But I do kind of feel like, you know, you were talking about Tesla a minute ago, and, you know, I was looking to just a number of securities yesterday morning, and I was looking at especially the tech stocks and especially the Mag 7, because those have just driven so much. And, you know, I was looking at things like Nvidia and Taiwan Semiconductor and Tesla and Microsoft and even just the SPY. And, you know, the three things I always look at are just relative strength, stochastics, and then just kind of what's their trend. And watching Tesla, it was just really amazing because everything, it was just printing at its high. Like, I think the stochastics were in the 90s and the, relative strength was as high as it's been at any point in the last 5 years. It had gone up, I think, 14 days in a row. And you could just feel it's like, it was like running up a hill and it's just getting to the top and it just can't go any higher. And so when we had the pullback yesterday, it wasn't so surprising. We had a decent bounce today. And then again, by the end of the day, things kind of started to act like they were a little tired and pulled back a little. I think next week is really a critical week, because I think in order to kind of keep powering through the end of the summer without getting a summer correction, I think it needs to not only make a new high next week, but I think it needs to finish the week at a new high. I think it's very possible we come in and Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, we're kind of at these levels, maybe a little bit higher, and then roll over by the end of the week. Again, I'm not saying there's going to be a crash, but I think for me to kind of take this correction off the table, I think we would have to really just really power higher next week. And you know, I think I'm going to wait for it to prove it to me, because to me, it just seems like we're kind of at these levels where it needs a rest. The other thing that was kind of interesting for me this week was watching the dollar. And, we always kind of talk about the dollar a little bit, but we never really focus specifically on the dollar. But to me, what's interesting about the dollar is that you would think, because for all the people that say that the dollar is doomed and, you know, they're going to have to print. And the dollar's basically gone sideways for a couple of years now. And you would think if markets were at their all-time highs and, you know, unemployment was low, you would almost think, and things are just ripping higher, you would almost think that was the general view would be that's a weak dollar environment. Or that's almost like a QE environment where everything just keeps going higher and higher and higher. But it's not. You know, the dollar's basically gone sideways. It's not falling. And, you know, the Fed isn't printing money. The Fed still has very restrictive monetary policy with rates over 5%. And so I kind of sometimes want to grab people and just shake them and say, why do you want rate cuts? You know, we've talked many times, and you kind of pointed this out, I don't know, 3 or 4 months ago, that, you know, we're kind of getting the milkshake because it's the higher rates. And I sent a tweet out, somebody can go find it if they want, but I sent a tweet out the other day saying everybody that's banking on these rate cuts to extend the equity market higher, I think they need to kind of reexamine why markets have rallied higher over the last year and a half, 2 years to begin with. They didn't ramp because interest rates were falling. They ramped when interest rates were very high. Now, there's an expectation they're going to fall, but they have stayed high. And high relative rates is what has pulled capital into the U.S. markets, because you get paid more to park your money in the United States. And then that leaks into different asset prices, where it's whether it's home prices or whether it's stock prices or whether it's, you know, other some commodity prices. And if you think about it, if the Fed is going to be cutting rates, if they just cut once or twice, it's probably not a big deal, because we would still be much higher than the rest of the world on a relative basis. But if we are cutting all of a sudden to where we are now lower versus other currencies, then we become a less desirable destination. And so I kind of feel like what could very well happen is I feel like we could get some kind of a correction in the next month. Then we get into September and the Fed cuts and the market takes off initially, just kind of a relief rally. Finally, we got the rate cut, right? And then a week, 2 weeks later, they're like, well, why is the Fed cutting? What are they seeing that we're not seeing? Now we get paid less to be in the U.S. Are they going to cut again? You know, if they're going to cut again, maybe we should get out in front of that. So then they pull, you know, they sell the dollar, or that they sell dollar assets. And so I guess my point is a massive rate cutting. If people are banking on a massive rate cutting cycle to send markets from, you know, the S&P from 5,600 to 6,600, I don't know that a massive rate cutting cycle is what does it, because I think a massive rate cut cycle would be the Fed cutting into weakness or cutting into some kind of a crisis. I actually think the best thing they could do would be just cut once or twice, small cuts, and then keep relatively high rates. And I think that might be what ends up happening, because we're not seeing inflation plummet. You know, we're seeing it come down, and we're seeing it, you know, we're seeing the Fed make progress on it. But, you know, these readings that come in, they're still, you know, one of them will be a little bit low and the next one will be a little bit high. You know, the jobs number was okay a week ago. And, you know, so of course it's, you know, probably a lot of it's, you know, suspicious to say the least. But my point is I don't know that the Fed is going to have as easy a time doing multiple rate cuts as many seem to be expecting them to do.
So a couple things I want to pull on there. Before we do that, I'm going to backtrack a minute. So at the start of the show, I had made the point about, you know, we have these Super Bowl type events or economic reports that come out and then things kind of go quiet and people get bored. Very much alluring to what you just mentioned, which is next week, it's very, very quiet. And the markets now have an opportunity to just sit with the information. And so it's always very interesting to see how markets continue to process the data, not just that knee-jerk reaction. The more they have time to think about it and literally have the ponderings and conversations like you and I are right now. One other thing I want to mention before I forget, you talked about this index divergence. This is actually something that you had posted a couple of days ago before the response to CPI. On Macro Alchemist, we had a chart where you showed the indexes. It'd be interesting for you to do an updated version of that, showing some of that compression now that the Russell has kind of sprung back. Going into some of the things that are more dollar milkshake related that you just mentioned, what's interesting is the idea here that we already are in the milkshake to some extent, that the higher interest rates from the Fed has been drawing in capital. One of the things I want you to maybe touch on a little bit is either intentionally or accidentally, they've realized that this has allowed them to kind of weaponize the dollar in a lot of ways. So if we're suddenly in a situation, one, you know, token rate cut's not going to do it. But the point that you're making is, do markets start to question the why? Is the why legitimate, meaning we're having some kind of economic contraction or one is on the horizon, therefore more rates are coming? And the types of things that we've seen as far as carry trades have been going on that have been pumping liquidity into the market, maybe simultaneously, it's no longer the type of geopolitical or weaponization of dollar that the U.S. government wants to do, while also simultaneously, markets and liquidity around the world are thinking twice about how long they want to sit in the dollar, and you start to have this kind of like combination of inertia going the opposite direction.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because when I first mentioned this whole thesis, it was 2018. We've referenced this many times. And in the very first time that I mentioned it, I mentioned the higher rates in the U.S. would pull capital in the U.S. And I said it's basically the ultimate expression of Soros's imperial circle. And again, I've mentioned this several times on the show, but I'll mention it again now for people who aren't familiar with it. You know, in his book, The Alchemy of Finance, he mentioned it, and him and Druckenmiller put this trade on in Germany back in the 80s. But it was basically the idea that, tight monetary policy or higher rates is often seen as a tool to slow the economy and move asset prices lower. And it makes sense, right? If the cost of capital is higher, you have a higher hurdle to jump over. You know, it's harder to borrow money. You know, it's not as liquid out there, and so asset prices pull back. I mean, that is the reason the Fed raised rates in the first place, was to slow the economy. But Soros said, you know, that's not all. It won't always work the way you think it works, and it won't always mean asset prices fall, especially in a situation where you're in a country that is desirable to foreigners and where the local government has very loose fiscal policy. In other words, the government is spending a lot of money, which in and of itself kind of stimulates the economy. So you get kind of a double whammy of capital from outside the US coming into the market, which pushes it higher, and you get capital being spent from the government, which pushes it higher. And so you get this kind of this cycle. It's like a vicious cycle where it pushes asset prices higher. And this is what I've always said, the dollar milkshake theory is, it's really just the ultimate expression of this imperial circle, because it's not happening in some random country in Europe or Africa or Asia. It's happening in the biggest market in the world, and it's happening with the global reserve currency. And I think that's very much what we're seeing. And so my point is massive rate cuts would potentially remove one of the features of that imperial circle. Now, if the US is cutting massively and the rest of the world is also cutting massively at the same time, then perhaps it doesn't matter. And perhaps the US still gets the flows as a safe haven trade. But my point is that higher rates have not been a huge detriment to the economy for a couple of reasons. One, as we've spoken many times on this show, until you hit the wall, higher rates are actually stimulative. And the higher rates draw capital in from all over the world. And, you know, all you have to do is look at the net international investment position of the United States. It continues to grow because the people around the world want to buy U.S. assets. And our equity markets and our, you know, real estate markets continue to outperform much of the rest of the world. I mean, you look at China, you know, a lot of times, I can't tell you how many times either on Twitter or podcasts or debates where I'm constantly told that China just is always beating the US in everything. And yet China's, you know, their stock market is down tremendously. Their real estate market has crashed. Their banking system is in real trouble. Several banks closed again this week because of the bad assets, and they had to be absorbed by, you know, bigger, larger banks. But even the bigger, larger banks are in trouble. There, the M2 of China is around 38 or 40, between, I think it's like 40 trillion. And their economy is about 18 trillion. So their banking system, all the loans for their corporations, their real estate, their economy is basically levered three times. Now, the United States, as contrast, our M2 is around 25, 26 trillion, and our economy is around 25. 20. So it's like 100%. So it's got a 1x, whereas China's like got a 3x or even 3.5x. And so China's banking system, China's economy is much more levered than the United States. A lot of times people will say the US has all this debt, how are they ever going to deal with it? Well, you know what? China's got three, on a relative basis, China's got three times the amount of debt. And that's why their economy is trailing the United States, because the bad debts are having to be absorbed, and it's putting tremendous deflationary pressure on their economy. So the other thing that came out this week, and you know, got a lot of attention, was I think the monthly interest payment was like $120 billion. And so you annualize that, and it's like, you know, $1.2 trillion in interest payments this year. And it's now I think it is either now or it will be very soon the single biggest line item, you know, expense for the United States budget. And everybody will say that this is just a disaster and, you know, this is going to end really badly. And listen, it will. It will end badly. I'm not discounting that. But higher rates in the U.S., the idea that higher rates in the U.S. are singularly bad for the United States and not bad for the rest of the world is to misunderstand how the system is designed in the first place. It's these higher rates that is partly causing the Japanese yen to fall. And, you know, they're having to deal with that crisis. The higher U.S. rates are partly what's causing Germany's economy to stall and fall. The higher U.S. rates are what's causing China's economy to, you know, buckle under the deflationary pressures and its bad real estate loans. So again, when you hear about these bad things that are happening in the United States, it's not that you should ignore them. It's not that you should say they don't matter. It's just that you have to keep it in perspective, because everything that everybody's worried about one day happening to the U.S. is already happening in China. It's already happening in Japan, and it's already happening in Germany. So, because it's happening those other places, the dollar and the U.S. market is still getting flows because global asset allocators have to put their money somewhere. I've said this many times. You as an individual who's listening to this, perhaps you have the ability to kind of check out, you know, take your money out of the market, put your money on the sideline, go hide out on some mountaintop somewhere and re-engage later on when the coast is clear. But the big asset allocators, the big pension fund managers, the central bankers, the corporate CFOs, the people that run endowments, they don't have that option. They can't check out and come back in 10 years. So they are going to put their money somewhere. And more often than not, that somewhere is in U.S. assets. And part of the reason is because you get treated the best from a legal perspective and you get paid the most from an interest rate perspective. It doesn't mean you're treated great. It just means you're treated better. And it doesn't mean that the interest rates are great. It just means that they're better. And so, you know, you can't just look at things from one point of view.
Yeah. And one of the things too, that's very interesting going through this conversation here on YouTube with our channel and the stuff that we do on Twitter is I think each medium has its own echo chamber. And depending on how you've come across Brent and our conversations, if you're primarily doing so on YouTube or just an audio podcast, there's a whole other part of the conversation you're often missing. And it's not just ours. It's whatever one that you listen to most frequently. And oftentimes we like hearing our ideas and opinions repeated back to us. And so oftentimes we get warped into these echo chambers. One of the reasons we love spending so much time on Twitter is not only is it funny, but it's the one place where you're instantly checked the second you say something foolishly or unresearched or deeply from a bias. And probably more than anything, this end of the dollar, BRICS, China is rising to the top, you know, gold is going to outshine everything. A lot of these narratives make sense. There's some value in thinking about them. But when you just fall in love with the story and then you're in an echo chamber, have a particular bias, you're only looking at one half of the information that someone else is just regurgitating because it makes them feel good because it reinforces their bias. And I'm sharing this and giving this context and this perspective because one of the things that's often really funny is, you know, these various arguments about the end of the dollar regime, et cetera. And just this week, we had two incredibly stellar auctions. I think it was a 2-year and the 10-year bond auction. At the same time, we had the Japanese yen blowing out above 160 and the BOJ having to intervene again. I think they stealthily Yep. did that amidst a huge bond rally after the CPI data. A lot of people, I think, missed that. One of the downward pressures on bonds that day was the BOJ Yeah. selling U.S. Yeah. treasuries to basically defend their peg. So one other piece to that I want you to talk about is you mentioned M2. First, explain what M2 is so they understand this, the leverage argument you made between the U.S. and China's banking system. But also you've recently made a comment about M2 and gold reserves, because that's always a big one too, is, you know, China's buying up all this gold and they're going to do this big sneak attack, dump the dollar and create their own global reserve currency. So maybe you can share a little bit of insight or argument against this whole idea that, you know, China's playing 3D chess with gold reserves.
Yeah, so I'll tell you about the monetary aggregates. M2 is one of the monetary aggregates. And this is really important to understand. And this is something that I'm going to cover in the Milkshake Masterclass that we're going to do next month. And I know people are saying, well, you've said this many times. What's the actual date?
We're working on it.
It's coming. Trust me, it's coming. But one of the things I'm going to cover in there is you have to understand the design of the system to understand the demand for money or demand for currency. And remember, every country's currency and monetary system is designed the same way. There's no country of any significance that's on any kind of a gold standard right now. And so, you know, if you think that the U.S. has a Ponzi scheme, then you think that Great Britain's a Ponzi scheme and Italy's a Ponzi scheme and China is a Ponzi scheme and Russia. I mean, they all have the same thing, and they have various levels of debt and various levels of reserves, but they all have the same type of monetary system. And essentially what it is it's a fractionally reserved system. So they have base money. And so in the U.S.'s case, I'm going to explain the U.S., but again, it's the same, you know, all over the place. There is base money. Base money is the physical currency and coins that actually exist in the real world. These are physical existing monetary instruments. And then the reserves that are at the central bank, those are held in reserve. Those used to be physical as well. They're not anymore, but those are things that are held in reserve. Those cannot be taken out and gone and used to buy pencils or to buy a car. Those are reserves that sit at the Fed or in the bank that are then used as collateral to loan new money into existence. So the base money does not get loaned out. The base money is the collateral off of which new money is loaned into existence. So then you've got M1, M2, M3. Everyone gets a little bigger and bigger and bigger. But the thing that you have to remember is that when you look at these various levels of monetary aggregates, again, base money is the smallest, M1's a little bit bigger, M2 is a little bit bigger than that, M3 is a little bit bigger, and then you get into shadow banking and all these, you know, various forms of credit that's been extended, and it just gets bigger and bigger and bigger. But the important thing to remember is those are often referred to as the money supply. And oftentimes you'll say M2 is the money supply. It's the amount of money that's in the system. That is true. But in this particular type of a system, the supply is also demand. Now, I'm going to say that again. In a fractionally reserved monetary system where new money is loaned into existence, supply is not only supply, it's actually demand. And what it is demand for the base money off of which it has been loaned into existence using. So what I mean by that is, when money is loaned into existence, and as long as it's circulating, and as long as the music's playing, and as long as, you know, you go to the grocery store and you buy a gallon of milk, and the store takes the money that you bought the milk, and he goes and he pays his rent, and the person who's received the rent goes and puts gas in his car, as long as people are transacting, and as long as that money is circulating, then there's no problem. But when you get into a situation like 2008, when nobody wants to lend anymore because bad debts are exploding, or when you get into a situation like 2020 with COVID, when nobody wants to spend nobody can spend because they're locked down in their homes, and the velocity of money falls to zero, and that money is no longer circulating, so debts start to you start to get a credit contraction. What's happening there is the music has stopped, and so there's 10 chairs, but there's 50 people swimming or circling around it. So think of the base money like the chairs, and think of M2 like the people circulating around it. Because all that M2 is it's a claim on the base money, right? And so when circulation stops happening, everybody starts clamoring for the base money. It's like a bank run. If everybody goes to the bank on the same day and asks for their money back, there's not enough money in the bank to give everybody their money because it's fractionally reserved. And so when that happens, each individual dollar that does exist rises in value because there's so much demand. There's so much demand, but not very much supply. And so again, when you think about monetary aggregates, you have to understand that they're not just supply. They're supply as long as it's circulating. The minute it stops circulating, it becomes demand for the base money. And so that is why it's important to understand how leveraged a system is. So when we go back to, when I say the U.S. is leveraged 100, or it's 1-to-1, So there's 20 chairs and there's 20 people circulating around it, right? Or there's 20 chairs and there's 10, or there's 10 chairs and there's 20 people circulating around it. But in China's case, there's 10 chairs and there's 30 or 40 people circulating around it. So there's more competition for the base money. So there, so in other words, less people are going to get a chair. And so more people are going to be kind of SOL, so to speak, when the music stops. And so that's why it's important to understand monetary aggregates. And that's why it's important to understand when a country's banking system is very highly leveraged and that economy starts to slow, really bad things happen.
All right, Brent, that was great. But before we wrap up, can you add a little context to what you just explained in terms of the money aggregates in M2, but how they relate to gold reserves? Because as I mentioned, that's oftentimes one of the big arguments people make is that China's buying all this gold and that's going to be their sneak attack weapon later on, converting to some sort of gold-backed currency.
Yeah, so if you kind of did the same, you know, calculations, you take each country's gold reserves, and I've put this report out, I send it out like once or twice a year, I update it once or twice a year. But basically, if you look at each country's gold reserves, you take it times the value of the current value of gold, and then you compare that value to the value of their M1, M2, M3, again, you find out that China's banking system is much more levered to their gold reserves than the United States banking system is relative to its gold reserves. The idea that China can all of a sudden just launch this gold-backed currency and they're going to be fine, and the U.S. is going to, you know, end up in this, you know, ashtray of you know, currency debasement. It doesn't make any sense, because the U.S. could do the same thing, and U.S. has more gold than anybody. And, you know, I know people say, well, China has a lot more gold than they say they do. Well, you know, I can say the U.S. has a lot more gold than it says it has as well. There's no proof to this. So, but the point is that all the central banks have gold. You know, it's not like one country can use it against the other country. And that other country couldn't do the same thing that they're doing if they had to do it. I don't think any country wants to do it. The idea that Xi or Putin wants a gold standard, we've talked about this several times, I think is a non-starter. But yeah, so, you know, it just goes back to when everything is a relative game. And, you know, it's one thing to say China's buying gold. It's one thing to say the U.S. has all these problems. But when you look at the, you know, the U.S. banking system to its M2 and the Chinese banking system to its M2, and then also to the gold reserves, China is much more, is a much more levered country than the United States.
Thanks, Brent. We appreciate the conversation. I think we covered a lot of things, including what happened this week, as well as some of the inner workings in the financial system, which we'll get into in the Milkshakes Masterclass. You still have time to send us an email if you're curious of being on the early bird list. You can do so just by saying a quick hello at masterclass@milkshakespod.com. Next week, as we've been discussing, is going to be a quiet one, so it'll be interesting to see how markets continue to process the data that we've had this week. And then the following week, I believe, we'll have the PCE data that will reinforce potentially the idea that the Fed could cut a small token cut of 25 basis points in September. Until then, everyone, enjoy your weekend. If you're in the Northern Hemisphere, enjoy the summer. If you're in the South, find yourself a cool sweater like I have. Until then, we'll talk to everybody on the next episode. Take care. This show is provided for entertainment and informational purposes only. It should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. Neither the hosts, guests, nor any funds they may manage intends to make an offer or solicitation for the sale or purchase of any specific securities, investments, or investment strategies.